Thank you. Francis and organizers, thank you very much for inviting me here. Nancy, thank you for the nice introduction. I will talk about some experimental results on synchronous dynamics of spikes and LFPs in STN. Some modeling results considering the same phenomena and a few applications of this stuff, in particular delayed feedback DBS. I guess I'm fighting with my microphone. So I want to start with this slide, which is usually at the end. Few collaborators, Chun-Suk Park, who is now at University of Pittsburgh, he is here. Sang Wuan, who is in this room as well. Oops. For some reason, I have a problem with microphone. My graduate student, Adriana Vranek, and two of my clinical collaborators, neurosurgeon Bob Worth and neurologist Liz Zauber. Everybody is from Indiana University, Virginia, Indianapolis, or IU Medical School. So let me start with this brief motivational slide. Maybe it's a little bit redundant now after these two talks. Just to set everybody at this mode that beta oscillations are somehow functionally related to hypokinetic symptoms of Parkinson's disease. This connection is still under exploration. One may argue if beta is a reason or a consequence of symptoms, and yes, it's still unsettled. Especially given these two talks before, I think there is kind of a consensus that beta band rhythmicity is definitely related to slowness of movement in Parkinson's disease. And moreover, most of the, if not all, non-therapeutic interventions in Parkinson's, whether DBS, L-DOP, or other pharmacological interventions, if they improve akinesia, at the same time, they tend to suppress beta band oscillations and beta band synchrony. What do we do here? This is a more or less standard setup for DBS surgeries. Microelectrode, which is advanced down to subthalamic nucleus, and we simultaneously record spike in activity and local field potentials from the same electrode. We filter them, let me see where is the laser pointer, filter them to beta band. We detect oscillatory episodes. We reconstruct Hilbert phase, and then I'm going to talk about the synchrony patterns between spikes and local field potentials. So, of course, the signals are very much different, but when you filter them down to the beta band, you get a quasi-sinusoidal oscillations. And if we are to consider the interpretation of what happens when you filter spikes to the beta band, it's sort of an instantaneous firing rate of a sort. Not exactly instantaneous firing rate, but this is, somewhat similar to instantaneous firing rates, so that you have a peak in the filtered signal whenever you have a burst in the beta band in the original spiking signal. Let's discuss a little bit the issues of phase synchronization, just to make sure, especially for the more biological people here in the room, that everybody understands what we're doing here. So we reconstruct a phase, which is a more or less standard procedure for a narrow banded signal. And then we look at the phase difference between spike and LFP. So this is the phase of spike, this is the phase of LFP, this is the phase difference. It's more or less a standard approach. You can plot them on a unit circle and look at how this difference evolves in time. I have a problem with it. Do I really need a microphone or not? Can everybody hear me without it? Okay, I guess I'll keep it on my ear, but I'll pretend as if it doesn't work. So this is more or less a standard approach. You sum E rise to the I multiplied by the difference of phases. And this parameter, well, take it off, this parameter varies between 0 and 1, and zero corresponds to a non-correlated, uncoherent situation, and one corresponds to the case when all the phase difference vectors are aligned in the same direction. Practically speaking, you'll get something in between 0 and 1. It's never 0, it's never 1. But the likelier it is, the more phase tapering you have. Now, there are a few other things one can do here. Since you don't really know how large enough, you can introduce surrogate data. There are different ways to introduce a surrogate. You don't know the, what kind of distribution follows. You can start with the original data, do some random coupling and all this kind of stuff, and get a sense of what happens with it. And after I've gone through this procedure, you can look at what happens with this gamma, a synchrony parameter, computed over a relatively short time interval. So this would be an example of this. This is a synchrony, a phase synchrony. Yes, please. Absolutely.
So how do you actually define, like, the
spike phase
and the
LSP phase
at a moment in time?
Well, so you, this is a Hilbert phase. You do a Hilbert transform. You reconstruct the whatever analytic signal, the yellow part, imaginary part, include our change, and you get a phase.
You do this for both.
You do this for both, right. You do this for both. Now, technically speaking, I know this is what you're driving at or not. Spikes, when you experiment, start with experimental time periods, they get spikes. You need to take the high part of the spectrum, so to speak. But as when you're done with it, you can still subject it to low-pass filtering in the data band. It will have very low amplitude signal, but these bumps in the filtering will roughly correspond to the location of bursts. So that what we see here is a sequence of bursts, so to speak. And the Hilbert phase for spikes, the cycle 0 to 2 pi correspond to a jump from one burst in the beta band to the next burst in the beta band. So this is done for both signals for spikes and LC, and this is a so-called instantaneous synchrony. Now, there is no instantaneous synchrony per se, because synchrony is not an instantaneous phenomenon. You have to think the instance in time is not a synchrony yet. So each point here incorporates the dynamics of preceding time interval. You can make it longer, you can make it shorter. As you make it shorter, it kind of starts to lose significance. So in this case, I believe this time interval is of the order of a second. And this line is what we get with the surrogate data. So what we see here is that the synchrony fluctuates, and it fluctuates on a relatively short time scale. Of course, it fluctuates on a longer time scale as well, especially if this is a living human who may move and so on. But even at rest on a short time scale, it fluctuates. It may be somewhat similar to the experiments Michel mentioned when they reported from Fayatum that you get this bouts of beta band activity in LSP and then it disappears. With one difference, here we do check for the existence of beta band oscillations in beta and in spike. They're not always there. Basically, we need to go through the time series, take some parts away, and keep on with those parts where oscillations are present in both cases. The sensitivity goes up and down, and this is what we want to study for a number of reasons, in particular because it may help us to match the modeling results with experimental results we see here. And one of the questions is what kind of system, well, in the mathematical sense, if you want, is able to reproduce this variability pattern. So the answer is many. And we want to go one more step to get a better way to describe this variability in time. So here's what we'll do. I'll describe this procedure quickly. We have the spike and LSP. Both are filters, the data band, so you get a quasi-sinusoidal signal. Now let's do this. It's more or less standard procedure. When one signal crosses zero on the way up, let's check the phase for the other signal and record this difference. So as you go from a cycle to cycle,
essentially have a sequence of phase difference. Now, 1,000 later, 2 cycles later, 2 cycles later, and so on. If this value is more or less constant, the signals are more or less in sync with each other. If this value fluctuates, well, you are not in sync. And these are the fluctuations which we're going to study. So we essentially construct a Fermi-Son map. Map which brings you from this point to this point to this point to this point. And for this particular piece of data, we have like about 10 points. They're all in this quadrant on the diagonal. And when you're in a perfect synchrony, you're always going to be on the diagonal, right? If I thought one to related signals, everything is spread out. Now, you see, we centered it in such a way that this cluster is at pi over 2 points, and that's kind of artificial. You can shift it on this circle any way you want, so this is what is done for the uniformity of the analysis, so that it's a kind of same situation when it's centered here. So this is the way how this map is constructed, and if you have a large piece of data for Parkinsonian patients, you end up with something like this. You see, and we'll quantify it later, you see that there is a more or less somewhat dense cluster near the diagonal, but there's a scatter of points almost everywhere. So now let's quantify this. Let's put some kind of numbers on this situation. So this is the phase space, and remember that these are the phases. So what you see here is in fact the torus. These two sides and these two sides are equivalent to the tau modulus 2 pi. We shift the phase in such a way that the synchronous dynamics we look at, absolutely synchronous, perfectly synchronous, would correspond to a point with the coordinates pi over 2 and pi over 2 on the diagonal. So now we partition this phase space into four different regions. This region is centered around this perfect synchrony, and then there are three other regions, and we will call this region 1 a synchronous region, but we have to understand that not everything in this region is perfectly synchronous. When you are at the first region, from a cycle to cycle, it means that as you move from one cycle to another cycle, the phase difference fluctuations are bounded by plus minus pi over 2 brackets. So they're not always in sync, but they don't deviate for the whole period. So what these arrows stand for? All possible transitions between the four regions of the phase space. These two coordinates are not completely independent, right? This is the phase difference now, and this is the phase difference one cycle later. So this is present, this is future, and your future is going to be your present one cycle later. So all the transitions you have, you may potentially get here are, in fact, you may just stay in the region one from cycle to cycle, that's a synchronous situation. If it's not in synchrony, the only way you can leave this region is to go down so that your future coordinate becomes negative, and that reflects the fact that you go here. From cycle 2, you can go, from region 2, you can go to region 3 or to region 4. In 3, you can stay in there or go to region 4, and from 4, you can come back to synchronous state, or you can get down to 2. Now, this diagram looks symmetric with respect to region 1 and region 3. However, since we study, and this is an important caveat here, the whole thing, the whole procedure makes sense if you have some degree of synchrony, if you have a preferred angle between these two time series. And that breaks the symmetry, that sets you to synchrony at this point, so that most of the time you're in region 1, not in region 3. If this is not the case, this may appear to be a synchronous space as well. But this is not a synchrony in classical sense, because we may have this kind of phase relationship and this kind of phase relationship, this and this. So that the average out, when you average out across the whole time series, you don't see any synchrony. So in that sense, the diagram is symmetric, but we can construct it only for the synchronous data, and that breaks the symmetry. Now, given this partition, we can just do some kind of symbolic dynamics, so to speak, description of this, so you can assign different numbers to your time series depending on where your point is, and you can compute the transition rate, how many times you leave this region 1 versus how what the fraction time you stay there. From region 2 you have rate, transition rate to region 4 and transition rate to region 3 and so forth, and that you have 4 rates which quantify the transition between the phase space, between the phase space regions here. Now, the transitions are not necessarily independent, so there may be some kind of a memory in this. They are a partition of the phase space. So transitioning from here to there may depend on the spot. So as we see in the data, this is partially correct. This effects are weak, but still existent. So now let me go and illustrate this with one simple model. It's a case of a skewed tent map. It's a nice linear map. This is an illustration of it. And it's not a good example to study the phase synchrony for a variety of reasons. But it's very transparent and somewhat analytically tractable, so I want to talk about this briefly. So we take this map, we couple them linearly, and for this linearly coupled case of piecewise linear maps, you can analytically compute transversely Abelian exponents so that you can analytically characterize the instability or stability of synchronized states. And transversal Lyapunov exponent is the same with respect to transformation from A to negative A. A is just a slope, A to 1 minus A. A is just a slope here. So you can take two different A's, you get two different maps, but they have the same transversal Lyapunov exponent. You can compute the critical value for this synchronized state to be stable, and now we set the tau for an epsilon below the critical value, so that the dynamic, the synchronous state is not stable. Here's what we get. So there are two different maps to look at. One is with A, the other is with 1 minus A. So here is A, what's that, B or whatever, this is one third or whatever, this is 1 minus. So basically you have two maps, different maps. Overall, the contraction expansion properties of the phase space on the average are the same, but they happen in different parts of the phase space. And the stability, because of this property, the stability of synchronized state is the same. So as we change epsilon, the transversal Lyapunov exponent doesn't vary between these two different coupled maps, but the transition rates are somewhat different. Right, so on the average, you have the same kind of dynamics here and there, but as you look at the details of how you leave the synchronized state, how quickly you get back, the transition rate can discriminate this difference. So this is what we do with the real data, with the real data as well. So basically speaking, the rate is just one of many ways to characterize the temporal pattern of synchrony. Think about the distinction between few short, few long out of sync episodes and many short out of sync episodes. On the average, you get the same synchrony, but the temporal patterning, is different, and this is what we looked at. So back to experimental data. This is the map recovered from experimental data, and what I have here is the following. So each point corresponds to a point recovered from the data. First I look at the synchronized region, and I draw a line to a point to which you get from it. So in the synchronized state, you either stay in, that's why everything is black here, or you go down. Most of the time you stay in, but sometimes you go down. About a third of cases you go down with respect to this particular episode. Now, from region 2, you can go here, but most of the time, you come here. From region 3, there are a few points, because you rarely get there, but from them, you usually go up. You may stay in, potentially. The construct of the map wouldn't prevent you from doing so, but with respect to real data, you always go up here. And from here, you can go back to region 2 or back to the United States, and most of the time, you get back to the United States. Okay? So if you plot, basically, whenever brain breaks the synchrony for one reason or another, it counts when it's weak, whatever, you get back very quickly. But it happens many times, it happens frequently. You can start with the data, compute the rate. This is the diagram of the rate computed over our sample of 10 patients, and I think there may be more than 10 SCNs for some of the cases for bilateral. R1, the rate with which you read the synchrony state, is about 1/3, and all the other rates are in the vicinity of 0.7, which, of course, suggests, well, something which I already told you, that you can break synchrony pretty frequently, but the trip back is very short. So essentially, you deal with the case when you have a relatively large number of relatively short out-of-phase events. So that if we plot a distribution of durations of this desynchronized events, most of them, let's forget one cycle of oscillation, or you may call it two, it depends on how you count. You have in sync, out of sync, back in sync, right? So there is just one point on the map where you're out of sync. And then as you look at how many longer out of phase desynchronized events you have, the histogram goes down. This is everything larger than five lumps together. You see different bars here and different bars here. That corresponds to different ways of averaging the signal. We have real data from patients, so some of them are shorter, some of them are long. You can weight them with respect to the duration of data and all those kind of things, but the message is more or less consistent. The rate staying more or less the same range. The histogram presents you with the predominance of pseudo synchronization, which, on a second thought, may be not much surprising. And if you're interested in this, we can discuss this later. But the point is here, with respect to Parkinson's disease modeling, is that this provides us with a way to quantify not only the average synchrony level. You can take the wonderful couple of them together, and depending on Kaplan's strength, you can get pretty much everything you want between 0 and 1, right? Provides you with a more definitive way to characterize the patterning of synchrony in time. So given this structure, qualitatively and quantitatively with this rate, we go to modeling. Won't spend much time here. This is by now more or less a standard model of Thurman, Rubin, Wilson, and Yu. Coincidentally, this is the 10th anniversary, right, of the model. So there was this brain and beer thing. It's a nice occasion to celebrate the 10th anniversary of this very stimulating model. Whatever the brain connectivity is, most of the stuff is thrown away. There is a sort of focus on cortex and subcortical pathways, and then within this on SCN and GPE, there is some connectivity retained in the model. GPE projects to two SCN cells, SCN projects to one GPE cell. Parietal input is extremely simple, just a constant current. Each cell is represented by convection-based equation. So this is the model. Correct or incorrect, of course, there are some things it doesn't take into account, but as was pointed out, many ways it's extremely rich in a potential through synchronized dynamics, and some of which happen to be very similar to what we see in experimental data. So this is modeling, let me see, this is modeling. This is experimental data, XSL with spiking and LST. Now ignore this low frequency fluctuation. This is a second or something, so this is a respiratory artifact. It's very low frequency. It's not going to interfere with the data band. This is the modeling spikes in modeling LSTs, and of course they look different, they're much more spiky. The way we can use modeling LST, we look at the synaptic current at a particular location plus synaptic current at nearby location with a smaller weight plus synaptic current at a more distant location with even smaller weight, and qualitatively the results do not depend on how you choose this weight. It's quite robust in this sense. Well, first of all, I want to put this picture on. This is this instantaneous, in big quotation marks, instantaneous variations of synchronous time. So this is the average synchronous phase over the preceding. No, this is a second or half a second. Six milliseconds of time. So it does fluctuate, and it's one may argue that this is kind of similar to what we see here, but again, the point is that you can take pretty much everything and get some variations. So what we want to get a look at is want to quantify this transition. So this is experiment. This is the same procedure done for the model data for some parameter values, and yes, we can get a reasonably good match. So bars are experimental, and dots, well, stars. Probably appear as dots for most of you. It's what we have from a model data, and the distribution of the synchronization events is kind of similar. Now, why this is why this may be essential, and sort of more essential than just the matching of an average synchrony level. When you match average synchrony level between model and experiment, what you essentially do, you kind of matching the on the average, the properties of synchronization manifold and some kind of general average properties of the rest of the phase space, how quickly this relinearization happens, how quickly you're injected back to the vicinity of unstable synchronized manifold. If you look at four rates, you get a more detailed description of the phase space. So it moves you one step closer to an equivalency of the phase space of a model system and real system of equivalency, not only of synchronized manifold, but of equivalency of the phase space at whole. So not only you look at how this synchrony is stable or unstable quantitatively, you also look at what happens at the rest of the phase space. So this is what we did for a set of different parameters, and these parameters are the strength of acquired ferrocurrent current and GPE to STN projection, something which was studied in the very first original Herman and colleagues paper 10 years ago, although that paper tends to focus on two extreme cases, this corner and this corner. So let me quickly explain what this is. This is a case of strong tau current. This is a large tau current that naturally makes things more synchronous, and it corresponds to depends on how you the models have some kind of a constant current to make a nice firing rate, and the acquired current in this sense may be distributed between this addition and the free hanging term. So anyway, this striatal inhibition gets stronger, so that GPE cells are more inhibited, and that essentially helps to make them more synchronized with STN input, because they don't have much of their own dynamics, which makes them more correlated with STN inputs to the cell. So this is the case of strong coupling, this is the case of weak coupling colors. This is a number of principal components in principal component analysis, which there are 10 cells in the model network, 10 STN cells in the model network, so it varies from 1 to 10. 1 is just one principal component, they all very correlated, 10, they're all independent in a linear sense, and that's computed for the phases, not for spikes. The spikes are fast, they may be misaligned a little bit, still abated and synchronous for the phase calculation. So red is synchronized, black is uncorrelated, and these two corners were studied earlier. However, what we see is that if we are to match this model with experimental data, we sit somewhere in this green area. So you see there are several contours here. They correspond to different ways of how you compute LSP. And model LSP computation is a very shaky business. We don't really know what's right in fusion, we don't really know what's the right way to compute it. So what we did here, we just took several different ways to look at spatial attenuation effect. But with this model, we even don't know if this stand model cell state points to the whole STN, part of the STN, and maybe it's twice as large as human STN. So I'm not sure about this thing. So it's somewhat sensitive to how you compute LST, but there is a common area on the boundary between unserrated and synchronized and synchronized dynamics, and within this area, not only average synchrony levels, but also patterns of synchrony. The gross structure of the phase space is similar in the experimental data and instrumental data and modeling. So there is this boundary region, but it's relatively wide, and what we see is that with respect to the model we have, we can naturally generate this variability just because the Kalman is not so strong. So in that sense, PD is not synchrony. It's a little bit greater than with synchrony, let's put it in this way. So that the actual difference between healthy state and pathological state may be quite moderate, and this is what others have been observing as well. So depending on whose group data you look at, you'll get different reports of how strong, how weak the synchrony is, but apparently this variations are between small and very small, and this is what we see with this model. And you don't really need any external input to this to generate this variability. Neither you need just some plasticity to generate it. It arises there, may arise there intrinsically in the context of this model. Although, if you have cortical or parietal input, may problem with calculus. Before I'll go further to the last part of my talk, I want to make a couple of comments about this. So, in a way, the model is somewhat deficient because the striatum is very simplistic here. There is no cortex, and we essentially need to artificially speed it up with respect to the classical model to get rates similar, to get oscillation frequency similar to what we have in our patient's data. We, at our defense, we've looked at a case when the parameters were misaligned and we had a weak data band periodic input to STN, and it didn't change things much. However, I guess my stronger argument is that besides the details of the model, there is also this similarity of the phase space, which may add phase into how much we should trust in this result. So now that we know where in the parameter space, where we have a realistic time series, where we have a realistic dynamics, not only time series, but the phase space, we want to look at one example of how adaptive delay feedback DBS behaves here at this region, where the synchrony is weak to begin with. So the next five minutes in the talk, I'll talk about the example of delayed feedback DBS. So what's this? That first probe I heard in the papers of Michael Rosenblum and Arkady Pikovsky about 2004, and then Peter Sasso is supposed to talk here tomorrow, made lots of studies with this in a more neuronal context. The idea is that you take a network of oscillators, you record the mean field, and you feed it back with a delay of a half a cycle, half a period, and this kind of a delay makes the synchronous state unstable. You can prove some rigorous results for degenerate simple all-to-all coupled state oscillators, things like that, an extensive numeric related to more realistic neuronal models. The advantage of this type of DBS, as opposed to classical high frequency or things like coordinated reset, which again I guess will be covered in Peter's lecture tomorrow, is that it's a vanishing feedback. When you desynchronize it, the input is zero, so this is your feedback, potentially zero amplitude signal, and that, of course, really much desired advantage, because at an optimal state, there is no stimulating current. It's vanishingly small. One of the problems with it is that my understanding is that it happened to be very hard to implement in practice. And we were bothered why, what's the issue here, so we decided to look at how it works not here, which was usually a common theme of studies, numerical studies, but at this region. So this is the setup. I'm going to run through it quickly. You record an LSP the way we did earlier. Well, this is all modeling results. They are processed, you filter it, they're subject to delay, linearly transform it in different ways, multiplied by concentration, the simulation strength, which you vary, and you set it back. And there are different spatial setups, just one neuron in this model, two adjacent neurons, three adjacent, two non-adjacent, and so forth. So the outcome is more or less the same. So then, depending on parameter values, either it works perfectly, it's synchronized, or it doesn't work at all. And we wanted to look at how it happens with respect to the different areas in the parameter space. So remember the parameter space. Synchronous, uncorrelated in this region of intermittent dynamics, realistic dynamics. So let's take this slice of the parameter space, which goes from synchronous to partially synchronous to uncorrelated, and see what happens with the effect of DBS, with delay DBS, as you vary its strength. So these are different ways to compute LSP, different spatial arrangements. So what happens is that red is elasticity in dynamics. This is what you need. You want to desynchronize it. Again, you estimate number of independent principal components. Yellow is a moderate improvement, empty circle, no improvement at all. When you have blue and black, you boost synchrony. This is undesirable. So if you start at this corner, when dynamics are synchronous, you can easily get an improvement with this delay DBS setup. And it doesn't really depend on how you do it spatially, you have the same, very much similar results for other spatial arrangements of electrodes. However, as you move to the left, as the coupling strength, you think due to Nicolaitian projections, decreases, and the baseline dynamics becomes less correlated, you boost synchrony. As you crank up the simulation strength, from no effect, you go to more synchronized dynamics, which is undesirable. And as you go from strong coupling to weak coupling, you see that your effect becomes weaker and weaker, and then you just make things worse. Now, let's see what the maximal possible outcome we can get there. So this is the part of the parameter space we look at. It's smaller than the original diagram. We just wanted to have less of numerical simulations. And what you see here, again, different setups, this thing I apply, so this is a synchronized case, this is unsynchronized case, this is the case of a realistic dynamic. We have colors when dynamics is less coherent. Blue is small improvement, yellow is larger improvement, red is more significant improvement. In terms of desynchronization, this is no effect. So we look at a maximum improvement as we vary the strength of simulation. You can easily get this with zero strength, so that there is no black here. You can always have things unharmed if simulation is zero, but then depending, and you look at the maximal best outcome. At this corner, in all the cases, you see a rather yellow. So you tend to desynchronize it, well, in this case, by two or three principal components with respect to what you start with. As you move to a realistic dynamic here, you see more and more points which are just white, so there is no effect. And this is achieved for zero stimulation strength. If stimulation strength is larger, then you don't improve things, you make synchronization stronger. So you see, with respect to this delay DBS, delay feedback DBS, if you apply it in synchronous regime, it works the way it's supposed to work nicely, but as you move to a more realistic dynamics, with this specific temporal variability patterns of synchrony, which is not synchronous to begin with, you see that this tends to fail. It's not to say that any adaptive DBS will fail. Phase resetting may have more advantages because it hopefully will be covered tomorrow. I guess because you sort of set the system into the state you know something about, and then you try to desynchronize it. But this is not the this is not the case here. So a couple of conclusions quickly. As we move to more realistic dynamics, it fails, and in fact it may boost thinking rather than suppress it. So two slides with overall conclusions. These two things are more or less three things are more or less certain about, so that we can get the based on the time series analysis we have, we see that the synchronicity spike synchrony in TV is really intermittent. It has this short but frequent desynchronization event, the structure which we can positively describe, and the variability apparently can be generated without plasticity, without much of an input. It intrinsically rises there when the calcium is not strong enough to stabilize synchronous state. And in this context, the weighted back DBS tends to do a very poor job in terms of desynchronization. And if you go further, you may conjecture that this intermittent synchrony may be just inheritance of a good function. You do need to create this transient bouts of synchronous dynamics of data bands for movement preparation, for movement stopping, whatever it is. Data is physiological, it's not on the back. And in TG, we maybe just shifted a little bit to this area and the parameter space so that we have more frequent desynchronization events than otherwise. And the whole thing is positioned in such a way that TD is on the boundary between synchronized and non-synchronized dynamics. I think, and I have some rational for it, that what we see with respect to the short distance may be in fact very, this is the last slide, very general setup. That in other neural systems, we may be given with a somewhat similar situation. And that means that from a mathematical perspective, the problem might want to focus not only on the properties of synchronized dynamics, stable or unstable, how much unstable, but also on the properties of the rest of the phase space, how it's structured in such a way that eventually you get injected back to the vicinity of unstable synchronization manifolds or its remains. And on a practical side, that suggests that all this analysis of different control schemes to synchronize something should be tested not only in the context of perfectly synchronous dynamics, but also in the more realistic context when the original dynamics is weakly synchronous and you want to make it even more synchronous. So thank you very much for your attention, and I guess Nancy will open for questions. Thank you. So I cannot give you an answer because this is what we're trying to do now and we don't know the answer. So clinically, we have a relatively small group of patients who have gone through the surgery, so they're all at a very advanced stage. And in that sense, we don't have much of variability in the data as one would expect. They're already there. Preclinically, this is something we just have started to look at, so what we are doing now, we're reporting EEG from, well, C3, C4, CG, like motor cortex electrodes, and we want to look at how this patterning, how this structure is related, how it develops in time, because you can, EEG is non-invasive, you can do it at early stage patients, and this is something we just have started, so this is why I have no answer. I guess the difference is going to be in the frequency, in how high this first bar in the histogram of durations is, but I, unfortunately, I cannot ask me 2 years from now. I think I have a very specific answer.
More questions?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the relationship
Yeah. So the parameter we vary here is the strength of the feedback. So what we want to do is to check how much of desynchronization you may have. We want to vary the strength because desynchronization will depend on the strength. Very strong signal may disentrain everything. There are some issues there. So you do want to span the wide range. And when the input is very weak, you have no change at all. So if it boosts synchrony, you will not boost it because the input is very weak. So what sits in this feedback, is very similar to what was studied by Rosenblum, Tass, and many others. You record a signal, you delay it. In this case, this is a non-linear feedback, so you have this complex amplitude. You do this absolute value of square of the absolute value of V multiplied by V, so and then it's also a differential feedback. The point is that you can do it in many different ways. You can compute, put the signal into one cell, into two cells, into three cells, and what we see here is apparently robust with respect to it. You may do one kind of feedback, another kind of feedback, one neuron, two neurons, three neurons, adjacent, non-adjacent. In all of these cases, the details are different, the ranges of improvement or disimprovement are going to be different. But as you look for a maximum improvement, you see more or less the same picture. Like I said, I might have it somewhere down there. Different electrode setup. So in almost all of the cases, you have covered region for the case of strength component, synchronized dynamics, and that kind of disappears as you move away from it. No, there is no optimization here in that sense. So what we do, we just take the signal, LSP, we delay it, and send it back. Now, it happens that this procedure, in the case of a very large network, destabilizes synchrony, and the value of the magnitude of the feedback approaches zero. So in that sense, you can probably formulate this as an optimization problem. But we're not focused on that, especially because this is a small system. We know that the signal tends down, the magnitude will go down as you stimulate here. But it's all very numeric and there are no any explicit criteria. And with respect to the small 10 GP kind of scan neurons, the effect of anything is going to be very small anyway. So that's not the.
One more question.
You have a partially synchronous regime, you see some oscillation, you kind of can phase out of space. And then you're talking about mildly desynchronized and mildly synchronizing them. The changes are small. So we frankly don't quite understand what happens here. We've been arguing about this for some time. And ideally, I guess mathematically it's going to be a neat problem. See what really happens there. But so far, it's just a numerical evidence. Without much of an understanding of what happens here, part of the problem may be that this rhythmicity is, of course, GP and SCM, though these models have some built-in propensity for bursting, but it's partially network induced, and maybe this somehow changes into place as the simulation that switches it off, and depending on where you switch it off, you'll get this increase in syncing or dissonance. So, but I'm not sure if it clarifies the situation much. So.
Let's thank you.
Thank you.